Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Ever heard of a popcorn-driven robot? This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you stories about the intersection of food and tech.
We're interested in building swarms of many cheap, small robots and powering them and driving them forward with as little effort and as little energy as possible.
We cover tech by land.
Imagine if you could cut fresh microgreens onto your salad and eat it while the greens are still fresh and nutritious and delicious and alive. That dream is real.
We cover tech by sea.
We're building software-based business services to help shellfish growers manage and grow their business.
And we cover tech in the social media stratosphere.
So it's not really necessarily an indictment on food media or for media consumption at all. It's how the robots decided that they were going to weight human interaction.
Tune in and get techie this week on Meat and Three, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Welcome to Heritage Radio Network, Feast Your Ears. We are in the middle of our summer fund drive and would love it if you became a member. If you listen to this show, if you listen to other shows, if it's your first time tuning in, if it's your thousandth time tuning in, it is a completely volunteer hosted organization. And so there are 35 other hosts other than me, and we do this every single week. And so please help keep us on the air. You can visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate. And there's lots of really cool gifts that you can get if you donate. There's beer koozies. You can get a custom ringtone for your phone, which I guess is still a thing. Mine generally just vibrates in my pocket. But if you want a custom ringtone, please donate $25 to HRN. You can get a t-shirt, subscription to Cherry Bomb Magazine, cheese board, lunch at Roberta's. So there's great prizes at all levels of donation. Today's theme is mead, which is the world's oldest fermented beverage. Mead may be the first alcoholic beverage that I had any kind of relationship to. When I was 12, I played Dungeons & Dragons. A lot. And the adventures we embarked on vicariously through our characters were, of course, tinged with a sort of medieval world of travelers and bandits and inns. And, of course, the drink for our orcs and elves and wizards was mead. So that was the first time I ever encountered it. It sounded kind of mystical and magical and something plucked from fantasy and history at the same time. Many years later, when I made my first mead, I wasn't wearing any armor or rolling dice for hit points, but I was thinking about a connection to our forebears who first took honey, that magical elixir of the bees, and figured out how to turn it into a refreshing, vitamin-rich, and stable beverage that has the added benefit of making you feel good. Mead has seen a rise in interest in the last decade or so as fermentation at home and in smaller scale commercial endeavors has picked up. And you can now buy mead at a lot of farmers markets, better wine shops, online, and direct from places like Honey's, which is the tasting room connected to Enlightenment Wines, who have their meadery at 93 Scott Avenue here in Brooklyn. My guest today is Raphael Lyon, who's the owner and operator of both and the founder of New York Mead Day, which will bring together New York State-based meaderies this coming weekend on August 5th for a meeting of the meads with tastings, Mead University, a brewery tour at Enlightenment Wines, and a whole lot more. Thanks, Raphael, for coming to the studio.
Oh, thanks, Harry. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, my first encounter with mead, like I said, was like Dungeons and Dragons as a kid. Like it appeared, I feel like, in a lot of that kind of like mystical medieval stuff. What was your first time encountering mead?
Oh, that's interesting. The first time I had mead, I made it.
Nice.
To be honest. I was making cider. This was 20 years ago. So, and then I think, you know, I was pretty quickly like thinking through, okay, I wanted to kind of get serious about this. And if you make wine strength alcohol, which mead tends to be, so you're like 12%, you can kind of make a lot more in less space, and it's a lot less work. So
it is certainly more bang for your buck. I mean, yeah. I started out homebrewing beers, fairly low alcohol beers, so like 4 or 5%. And you're right; as soon as you graduate into mead,
one party, and you made making a I remember I made a beer, and I'm not saying it was good, but it was good enough.
Right.
And we drank it in one party. You end up with 2 cases of beer or something. You make 6 gallons of mead. That's going to stick around for a few months.
Right.
And so that was sort of the first move. And then the second thing that became clear to me pretty quickly was that it had this enormous palate to work in. Because, for those who don't know, mead is made like grape wine. It's basically the same techniques, except instead of starting with grapes, you're starting with honey, or more typically honey and another kind of fruit juice, or honey and an herb, or herbs, or some combination of all three. So you've got this wide range of fruits that you can work with, and herbs, and I have a kind of herb background, so that was really fun for me. I realized I could use a lot of the locally grown plants, sort of incorporate them into what I was doing. And then over time, over the years, mostly through reading and sort of talking to anthropologists and things like that, I started to have a much deeper understanding of what the kind of real historical background is for mead. And it turns out to be surprisingly different than a lot of people assume.
So, I mean, what is that background?
Well,
what's the real background?
Well,
not the assumed background.
It's, you get a lot of kind of medieval Game of Thrones and Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, which I should remind people are both entirely fictional, right?
Yeah.
So, it's not really a place to go looking for facts around an actual beverage, which is real. So,
sure.
The
elves in my, childhood Dungeons and Dragons were not real.
And neither
was the theoretical beverage they were drinking.
Right. So what is real is that pretty much practically every human culture that's been civilized has kept bees. And back to the Romans, back to the Egyptians, where India is now and Asia, Chinese, they all had bees. They were all making honey. And they were all making honey wine. So you will find some kind of mead pretty much in almost any civilization that you look. And that includes Northern Europe. That includes the Vikings, but it's certainly not limited to them. And I think it's really important to be very specific about this, because if you put a kind of Western white idea of what was going on in the, 500s or something. If you put Northern European food culture at the center of what mead is, you're really making a mistake.
Sure.
And because it's just, it's not inaccurate, but it doesn't make any sense to put any weight there. And the truth is most mead is drunk by black people in Africa today. Mm. So it's certainly not a white beverage, and it's definitely a global beverage. So I like that. But it also introduces some kind of other issues, which are if you want to be an authentic brewer in some way, right? And you want to make Kolsch beer. That's like a real beer that's been made for a few hundred years in the same place with a certain set of ingredients, and it's got some parameters, has a certain kind of water. And you can kind of come to make an authentic version of that, you can kind of make a kind of a copy, make something close, right?
Yep.
If you want to make an authentic mead, now you've got some real big questions, because unlike beer, which has always been made industrially and in factories, like all the way back to Egypt, mead has been made in people's homes pretty much, in the way that people might make kombucha or they might make pickles. It wasn't really an industrialized process. So mead will change really radically from house to house, from when it was made, and also from where it was made. So the most authentic kind of mead that you can drink is really one that says, okay, what's growing around me? What can I use that's in this region? That's what authentic mead making is. And so the meads that we make are really specific to what grows in New York State. And I think that they're deeply authentic. But I also don't think any of them have been made historically, specifically, right?
Right, right.
So that's
you're continuing in a tradition of making a honey-based wine with flavorings local and honey that's local, not continuing in a stylistic tradition like you would if you were brewing.
I would also say that around that word flavor, it's something to it's another thing that I kind of want to pull out. you wouldn't really flavor, you wouldn't say you would flavor a beer with hops, right? Hops are integral to the beer making process. And not just because they change the flavor, but because they affect the bacteria, they preserve the beer, they add tannins, which help clear the beer. There's a lot going on with hops, and I think a lot of people are familiar with that. In mead, you have the same thing. So if I'm making a juniper, lavender, marjoram beer, a lot of those herbs are part of the, I'm sorry, mead. A lot of that is part of the mead making process. So I don't like to, I think there's a lot of meaderies out there who sort of make a base mead, and then they do. They literally flavor it in different directions.
Yep.
And it's a lot like making soda or seltzer. And I don't really think that's a great way to think about making mead. I think like really great mead is done when all the ingredients are sort of processed throughout the procedure and sort of they're not just like pushing the mead in a direction. They're actually transforming it.
So your process then is to ferment everything together
typically
towards
yeah.
a final product. Yeah.
Although in the case of some botanicals, depending on what you're trying to extract, you might want there to be alcohol in your mead to do an alcohol extraction.
Yeah.
Or if you don't want an alcohol extraction, you might want to do them earlier. So it depends for sure.
Can you talk me through a little bit about the process you employ at Enlightenment, like start to finish? How mm-hmm. long does it take for you to make a finished mead? I mean, I assume some of them are aged longer than mm-hmm. others and that kind of thing, but just in a very basic sense, you start with honey, and where's your honey coming from?
Our honey comes from the Finger Lakes. It's all raw honey. And we're a little bit uncharacteristic of the mead industry in the sense that we are natural mead makers, in the way that you might think about natural wine. So we're typically doing spontaneous fermentation.
Wow.
And we're typically not using sulfites. We're not filtering. A lot of meads, they'll go through and they just do a really fine filtration at the end. And we don't do that. So what we're trying to do is really not just work in this method, but also think through, like, obviously people like drinking this and they've been drinking it for 10,000 years. So what were the tools that they had? And what was the craft? Like, what did that look like? And in a way, you can go to places in the world where they still make mead, but you can also, there are also some fundamental constraints around alcohol that if you stick to them, you can start to work in the same kind of paths that people might have a long time ago. So spontaneous fermentation is one of them. We ferment practically all of our meads, I would say maybe 80%, using the yeast that comes in with the honey. Hmm. So it's not like we went to white labs and ordered a quote wild yeast. Yeah. Like we're actually using the yeast that comes in with the honey. And that means that, so just to talk about the process, we're basically, we take water from the well upstate from the original meadery location. And I bring that all back down to the city when we're fermenting down here. And then we dilute the honey with that. We try not to heat it because, you know, you don't want to break down the honey. So once it's diluted, depending on the process we're using, the yeast that have been on the flowers that got carried into the hives that are on the bees that go into the honey, and then I think largely live on the surface of the honey where there's a little bit of liquid, they're sort of in suspended animation. So it takes them a long time to wake up. And you got to keep an eye on things. You don't want other stuff to grow in there. But we've been pretty lucky. And eventually those yeasts will take over. And because it's a wild population, it's really variable. So you actually have hundreds of different kinds of yeast. And there's a lot of yeasts that make cool flavors, but they'll die out at 2 or 3% alcohol.
Sure.
So they get a chance to participate. And, you know, it's basically it's an ecosystem that you're sort of generating. And then eventually the yeast will eat all the sugars in the honey, and there are dozens of sugars, and they consume them in different orders, and they all have an effect on the final flavor and composition. And then eventually, at some point or other, these will also typically go in a wood barrel. Most of them almost right away.
Okay.
In some cases, I don't want any wood flavor, and I'll do them in a tank, stainless tank, but almost everything's going into wood these days. And then they sit in there for about a year. We will age some on the lees, which means that the fallen yeast will actually get to accumulate, and then we'll kick that up periodically. Other ones will rack, and after about a year, everything's sort of knit together. Then the mead will clear naturally. It won't have that sort of like thin flavor that comes from filtering out all the proteins. And then we just bottle it and we sell it.
Awesome. And then at Honey's, your tasting room, you also have it on tap, correct?
Right. So Enlightenment Wines Meadery, that's like our company. And then Honey's, and that's like, you know, what's on those labels. And then we, when we opened up our spot in Brooklyn, we also wanted to have a like a bar attached to it. But not just like a tasting room where you would just have mead, but rather sort of an image of a bar where the mead would be at home. So we have a really great cocktail program by my partner, Arlie Marks, which use some mead in the cocktails. Sometimes they don't. Nice selection of beer, a few wines, but mostly like very carefully curated stuff that sort of we feel like our mead as a kind of premium, high-end natural wine could fit really well with.
Yeah.
And so that's what we do at Honey's, and it's right, it's attached to the meadery, and you can see the meadery through the window. And then, recently we've been putting, you know, a lot of the expense is actually putting it in a bottle, and it was driving me crazy that we were like literally putting it in a bottle, bringing it to the front of the house and emptying the bottle and then putting throwing the bottle out. Like, you know,
right.
I mean, you have to put the label on them, you know, it's like everything's in my hand. So that was really crazy. So we,
right. So you don't even get a chance to put it out there in the world. You're just doing that and moving it 25 feet and then it's going to recycle.
I mean, if I was smart, I'd have like a tube go that went to the back, you know, but kegging's pretty good. It's really low greenhouse gas use, and we're not paying for like corks and labels that go in the garbage. So we typically, like if a new mead will come out, it'll go on draft and it'll probably stay there for 2 or 3 months. And then we start running out and then it becomes bottle service. And then eventually, you know, we usually sell out and then you can just get it by the glass. And
I mean, it's a, you know, it's a fleeting beverage that is also, I mean, one of the things that I love about it is that, you know, I feel like there are places where you can get now, you know, now natural wines become a big deal, and that really is a flavor of place and same sort of thing. You get this yeast, but you know, the craft beer explosion with people being nuanced, a little bit more nuanced about flavor and ingredients and different kinds of hops and different flavors in there doesn't really have that same thing. And so mead, I think, is an incredible way to explore that because you do have, as you point out, I mean, bees are, you know, have been integral for such a long time. They're integral to agriculture. They're everywhere. I mean, they're all over this country. And so the idea is, you know, I mean, the way I think about it, like you could have a small version of Enlightenment Wines anywhere there are honeybees in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why mead's growing so fast. So I brought, just to give people a sense of the range, right?
Yeah.
We make about 8 or 9 meads a year, which is probably way too much, but I guess I can't help myself. So, if you were to come out now, like that, we're sort of like a fashion line. So we have like this summer release, and the summer is like, we've got a apple mead, which is so these are cider apples that have been overwintered and they sort of shrink, and they're co-fermented with honey, and that's traditionally called a sizer. We have a black currant mead, which are black currants from the Hudson Valley, very dry, almost like a red wine. We can taste that. We've got a sparkling sour mead. So this is a co-fermentation with lactic bacteria, which I isolated from, and they're not the kind of beer lactic. So it's a much more complex, much more milky flavor. It's the kind that you might use for like a yogurt.
Oh, wow.
And we can try some of that. It's really wonderful. It's a pet nat, which means just because if we don't, you know, we need more things to do. after we make the mead, we put it in a bottle with some residual honey.
Yep.
It continues to ferment in the bottle. We get bubbles.
So it's bottle conditioned.
Bottle conditioned. Yeah.
Nice. Well, let's. Why don't we do this? We'll take a short break and hear from our sponsor, which is Wisconsin Cheese. Today, we'll pour some meads. Oh, that's good with the sparkling.
This would be great with cheddar. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we'll take a quick listen from them, and we'll get some stuff poured, and then we'll taste.
Okay. Sounds great.
I went down to North Carolina. Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin Cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the Farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sartori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com. Though I was caught up in a jam,
and I said, oh. Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. That was my daughter Moxie you just heard from in that appeal for you to help us out here at Heritage Radio Network and keep us on the air. Before the break, Raphael Lyon, who's my guest, if you're just joining us, Raphael owns Enlightenment Wines and also the bar Honey's, which is next to that at 93 Scott Avenue here in Brooklyn. And Enlightenment Wines is a meadery. And so we were about to taste some mead, and then we poured it. We went to break. I was gonna taste it, but we decided we should really talk about it first, for you out there listening. So, what we are about to taste is a new wine, right? This is part of the summer release.
It's like it's a year old.
And it is a Pet Nat, so it's a little bit bubbly, and it has you can't smell it through the radio yet. I hear that Google is working on that. But it's really amazing. It smells like a Pet Nat wine. It has like that little bit of funkiness on the nose at the beginning, and the honey is kind of way at the back on the nose.
Insert sounds of sipping.
Hmm. Yeah. You can definitely taste the, like, for lack of a better way to describe it, like what I'd describe as like the natural yeast flavor.
Well, yeah, it's sitting on the yeast, so that adds a little breadiness to it.
Hmm. It is really good, though, and I see what you mean. It would go really well with a sharp cheddar.
Yeah.
The fat in the cheddar, I think this would cut through. It's really nice.
It's also fun to start thinking about lactic acid, because the more I look into, like, thinking through natural mead making, I realize it has a lot to do with sake production and the way that they produce. Because honey on its own, it's got a very low pH, but doesn't really have a lot of acidity as a flavor. So the vast majority of mead makers are basically adding some kind of acid at some point to acidify the mead. And it'd be nice to like really get away from that. And one of the ways that they do that in sake production is they actually have a primary fermentation. Like, I don't know if you really call it fermentation exactly, but they're acidifying their rice with a lactic bacteria.
Sure.
I mean, nowadays they don't do it that much. They just add lactic acid, but it can be done. It just slows things down. So learning to really control that process, I think, opens up a lot of territory.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that you point out that most mead still and historically was made at home.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really, you know, the deeper I delve and the more information, I think, in the last few years that people are starting to look at the microbial world and how we as humans interact with it, there's so much more to it. I mean, I think, you know, if you asked someone 15, 20 years ago, you know, how was wine made or what, you know, what causes wine to be the way it is, they would have said, well, the yeast eat the sugar and create alcohol.
Right.
And that was kind of the end of the story. And you're like, okay, cool, I get it. The yeast eats the sugar, which in my brain is this pile of white powder.
Right.
And the yeast are these things that are very specific and they eat this white powder and it turns it into alcohol.
Right.
And it like, and you're like, oh, I get it. Okay. And then like, at least for me as a kid, you know, in the early, like, you know, teenage, like, dangers of alcohol stuff, it was like one beer equals one glass of wine
yeah,
equals one shot of vodka. And so in your brain, you're like, well, okay, there's this clear
alcohol liquid that appears in the same amount mm-hmm. appears in a 4 ounce glass sort of wine like and in a beer, and it's just kind of diluted. So I feel like it's a very dumbed down way. And now I think we're coming to understand how much more complex it is. And as you point out, especially when there are complex sugars mm-hmm. from a natural source, mm-hmm. that there are different yeasts which have different flavor profiles that consume those different sugars at different points. And then there's things like lactic acid mm-hmm. and, you know, lactobacillus that come into play, and how important that is, perhaps lowering the pH to a point that other yeasts can consume mm-hmm. more complex sugars that couldn't right. be consumed if the pH was higher, things like that.
Right, and then they all have well, the thing about bacteria is they're really tiny, and yeasts are much bigger. They're like, you know, ocean liners compared to, like, you know, like a bicycle or something.
Right, and we all think of them as being microscopic, and they are, but yes, their size comparison.
And so the yeasts do all kinds of weird stuff under all kinds of different conditions. Also, I think another thing should be said is that when you start to study mead and honey, you realize, like, actually most of the categories that we have for beer and wine and cider and mead now, they're pretty arbitrary, and they were kind of invented, you know, pretty recently in the mm-hmm. in the history of human alcohol making, which is the entire history of humanity.
Right.
You know, for 9,800 years, we made all kinds of weird stuff. And in the last 200 years, it's been like, okay, grape wine just has grapes in it. Beer is just beer, just, you know, grains. And mead is just honey. But actually, like, you start looking into these recipes, all that stuff was mixed up. The beer had honey in it. The grape wine had honey in it. The, you know, the beer had grapes in it. Like,
yep.
they all had herbs in them. And almost all of them were preserving medicinal herbs. So when you look at yarrow and juniper and mugwort and wormwood and all the artemisias and bog myrtle, and like you start looking at like what did they actually put in these, rosemary even, into these early meads and these gruits, these beers with herbs in them, they're all medicinal if they're not also psychoactive. So you start to see that the history of alcohol making is really wrapped up in the history of making medicine also.
Right.
And that you can't really like divorce those two if you want to have a kind of real history of this stuff.
Sure.
So for example, like I wanted to pour you, this is sort of coming off the winter, but this is a mead we make that, you know, we kind of call them our cocktail meads because we use them for cocktails. But
it has a great like plum color.
Yeah, so this is a red bottle with a dagger on it. We call it the dagger. It's a cherry botanical mead. You're not going to drink 5 ounces of this. This is something you would drink in a small glass, like having an Amaro. It's going to be quite bitter, really herbaceous, very, really wonderful to smell. You sip it. It's made with hemlock, yarrow, fir, and chamomile. So these are all important medicinal herbs that Native Americans would have, well, not the chamomile, but would have used in New England.
Right.
And... you know, they're preserved in the mead. And in a lot of ways, the mead is a carrier for the herbs rather than the other way around. And you'll still pick up a honey nose on this. But
for sure.
It's not like you're here to taste the honey. And actually, most meads were not made like just honey and water. They were almost always made with other herbs or fruits. And the fruits, because of the acidity, to bring acidity to the project. And the herbs to bring tannins, because you need both of those for healthy fermentation.
And then, you know, and then sort of the next stage, I mean, of course, as a vinegar maker, I, of course, think about mead as a basis for the next step mm-hmm. of then turning into vinegar. And I know you've done some vinegar projects. You haven't released anything, have you?
No, we're still, like, sort of accumulating. It turns out I don't like throwing out, like, we don't waste that much mead. And I was like, you know, if I'm going to make a lot of vinegar, I just basically have to, like, not drink it. So it's usually like at the end of racking something, you know,
there's a little bit left.
Yeah, so we've got some stuff. It turns out when you make natural mead, and I'm really encourage people who are interested in, who make mead at home, who are interested in natural mead making with spontaneous yeast and things like that. We'll talk about the mead day later, but come and talk to me about it because I'm a huge advocate. One of the things that happens when you make mead naturally and it's not sterile is that it becomes incredibly robust, right? So when you're done, the mead is, you know, about 12% alcohol. It's preserving itself.
Yep.
Right? And so at that point, it's actually quite hard to turn it into vinegar, even though for sure there is going to be, like, acidobacter in there, because everything's had a chance to be in there. But if it was going to turn to vinegar, it would have done it 6 months ago. So it's actually
quite... And at that high alcohol level,
yeah,
it's very hard for acidobacter to get a foothold.
And also... if you're not, if you're keeping an eye on your nutrition and you're not over like fertilizing it, which is basically adding nutrients, there's really very little for anything to eat.
Yeah.
So it was actually quite a trick for me to get it to turn into vinegar. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to turn into vinegar. On the other hand, if you buy a sterile commercial mead that's never seen an Acinetobacter, it's got a lot of residual sugar, it's low alcohol, these kind of short meads, or what they call session meads, those things historically would have never existed, right? So, because they don't preserve themselves. We can do them now because we have canning lines and everything's sterile, but you open that up, it's going to turn to vinegar pretty fast.
Yeah.
Which is sort of ironic because they're made in the most sterile situation,
that's
right?
That's true. That's a good point.
You know, once you start working with oak barrels, you have to kind of give up on a certain level of control, and you have to sort of go with the flow. It's a lot more like having a garden. You weed it, but you're not going to raise the earth and burn everything that's living in there. You just can't, you know. So you just have to work with the natural ecosystem, which is, I like.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, I think that's exciting, right? I mean, if, you know, if you just had a sort of catalog and you made four meads and that's all you made all the time, all year round, that's not. I mean, at least for me. And you don't seem to be the kind of person who would find that particularly interesting.
Look, you should rinse this out. Let's try one more.
Sure.
We just released a dandelion wine. So I've been making this probably forever. Every year I try and make it a little bit better. It's technically a dandelion mead, again, because the base is honey. But it's in the tradition of dandelion wine, which is a New England tonic that people would drink, you know, in the spring so they wouldn't get sick. It has an incredible amount of vitamins in it. And it's as close to like an authentic American Amaro as we have, because it's quite bitter, but it's really something we did in the New World.
So talk to me a little bit about how it's made.
It's lots of effort, right?
I mean, lots of work. I mean, the very first time you and I ever met, I think that you were just in, it was years ago, but you were in the process of just starting to collect for that year's dandelion wine.
The thing about dandelions is, like, even though they're sort of vilified as these crazy pests, they're actually only really in bloom for about a week.
Yeah.
Like when they're all out at once and when it's efficient for you to pick them. And that where that is sort of moves north as the season progresses. So you have to kind of go hunt them. You have to find a patch that's ready when you're ready to pick. And nowadays, we need like 200 pounds a year.
And when you say you need 200 pounds, you're talking about the yellow flowers.
Yeah, we're just picking the flowers. And it's like hands and knees, coolers, boombox, days outside, picking flowers.
Wow.
And then, we keep them cool. And then we bring them back down to the winery.
And do you have specific like fields where you know they're going to bloom and
I have specific fields where they might bloom. You know, they don't always do it. It's kind of confusing. So I'm looking to cultivate them. I don't think they necessarily taste that much better because they're hard to pick. But
there's some sweetness left.
Yeah, so this is the only one we have that's not a dry mead. I should say, we didn't mention this, but a lot of people think meads are going to be sweet because they're made out of honey. But every alcohol starts out as a sweet thing, and including mead. And if you ferment all the sugar out, what you get is sort of the smell of honey and the flavor of a honey and none of that sweetness. In the dandelion mead, we leave a little residual sweetness. So this is one of the only ones that has a sulfur preservative in it.
Sure,
so,
to kill the yeast and cause it
to stay keep, just a keep sweet. It from. You don't really kill the yeast. You just keep it from reproducing. So, and it's quite high alcohol. It's about 15%.
Okay.
So again, it's another aperitif. We serve this at Honey's over a cube of ice, and also we have a really nice cocktail with it.
Cool. Yeah, it's delicious, and you can taste the. I mean, to me, it tastes kind of like spring.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's if you. Yeah, I mean, you have to like this kind of stuff. It's not for everybody, you know. It's. But as one of the things that I've learned about the culture of winemaking, because I'm not really a trained winemaker, I didn't go to France and learn about grapes and things like that. But I've noticed because we sort of caucus with beer people, there's just a lot of home brewers in the world. There's a lot less home winemakers that we interact with.
Sure.
And in the beer world, there's a lot more interest in the mentality is a little bit more about like fermenting to a type, like we talked about earlier, like make a good version of a porter. In the wine world, it's a lot more about character. That's why you vintage wines. That's why they age in the bottle. They change over time. And transformation is really important. So we have a black currant wine. If it tasted like black currants, I would say that was a failure. It should change. It should be it should be different than black currants. Because you already have black currants. The point of winemaking is to transform things into something new.
Yeah. So, otherwise, you could just make black currant syrup and sugar, and that would preserve
And there are definitely mead makers out there who do that. They taste like tastes like blackcurrant syrup in a honey wine base. And so I think one of the things you want to look for in mead is not like familiar flavors, but unfamiliar flavors.
Yeah.
And the transformation. And I think for this, it's kind of like, what am I drinking? You know, it tastes like dirt and grass.
Yeah.
But it's got this deep, really rich bitterness. It's almost like a chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And you drink it like you drink a whiskey. You sip on it. It sort of fills your mouth, and then the complexity unveils itself, and it's a slow experience. Yeah.
So this dandelion wine is from dandelions that were picked in the spring of 2017, is that right?
It's so insane. I can't even get into it. You have to pick them twice.
Okay.
Because you have to pick them in the beginning of the process, because some of the flavors that you want, you need to actually cook out.
Okay.
And one of the wonderful things about mead is because you're starting with water. Unlike grape wine, you don't really want to be boiling your grape wine. I can boil the water and boil herbs in it, right?
Oh, sure.
As a base.
I never thought about that.
That's
with the honey to dissolve.
Yes, exactly.
Sugar.
So that's a huge advantage and one of the reasons why herbs work really well with mead. And whereas with the grape wine, your only option really is to stick the herbs in there at the end and do an extraction. So, yeah. So if you want tannins, if you want bitterness, you know, you're typically going to heat. If you want to use bark, something like that, you typically heat it. But for the top notes and stuff like that, you need to come in a year later and do a secondary infusion with fresh flowers. So it's like making kind of like a Solaris beer or something. You know, you're always like halfway. You only ever have half the mead.
Right. right.
Right. So you pick, and then half goes to last year's and half goes to the next year.
Right. Okay.
So it's crazy.
Wow.
It's kind of a lot of work and crazy.
But it is fantastic. It's delicious.
Oh, thank you. So also available, all this stuff's available online. If I will pitch for myself now. You can get them at enlightenmentwines.com, and we'll ship them to you. You can also come into the bar. We do a CSA, which is really fun. So 4 times a year, you get a box of mead, and it'll include like 3 of the new releases, so you don't have to worry about missing out, and often like a 4th bottle that no one else gets. So about 2.5 years ago when we first started, NHK, which is a Japanese TV station, came and interviewed me upstate, and we made a mead.
Oh,
they're like
cool.
The PBS of Japan.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
kind
of a big deal for people. I mean, I didn't know who they were. Anyway, 2.5 years later, mead's ready to drink. So but we didn't make that much. So that'll just be for the club members.
Cool. Are you sending some of it to?
Yeah,
send
I'll send
a bottle to the
yeah.
folks. At
yeah,
NHK.
I should.
That's really neat. You should.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So let's talk about Mead Day coming up this Sunday.
Yeah,
August 5th is the 2018. It's the first annual, one would expect.
First annual New York Mead Day.
New York Mead Day, and so it's going to feature Enlightenment Wines and some other meaderies: Salt Point Meadery, All Wise Meadery, Misto Mead, and 810 Mead Works.
That's right.
And all, you know, it's an incredible... I'm bummed I'm going to be out of town. I wish I was going to be around because it sounds like a really incredible opportunity for anyone who is interested, not just in mead, if you're interested in fermentation, if you're interested in cocktails, if you're interested in drinking, if you're interested in flavors, if you're, you know, any of those things, I think it's going to be a really worthwhile event.
Yeah, we tried to... I mean, there's all these like weird festivals where you have to pay $25 and then everyone gets drunk and like it's the beer, again, it's sort of this kind of beer brain thing. And,
right.
and I really wanted to structure this around the tastings that I've gone to for wine, where you get very small pours, but you go around. It's really educational. It's an educational opportunity. So we're not charging. It's free to come. You can bring the mead that you make at home. So for 2 hours... you have to RSVP, but basically you can come with your mead and you can come up to one of the tables and talk to one of the 5 meaderies from New York, and they'll give you advice. They'll say like, well, this tastes like this, try this, think about this. And they'll be able to, all the home mead makers can share. If you're thinking about maybe you make beer at home or you've made vinegar or grape wine or you want to try making mead, we're going to have a table set up for new mead makers with some literature and you can ask questions. So it's really informal, educational, and then... for the rest of the day, we'll have all the meaderies of New York. We'll be tasting their meads, and you'll walk around with a cup and try stuff, and then you can buy their bottles.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's a great opportunity. I mean, if there's anybody listening who has a wine cellar and or is looking to have access to these interesting things, I mean, this is probably the only place where you can buy mead from all of these meaderies.
Yeah.
At the same place.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. I mean, it's the first one. We don't know. We had a huge response. Hopefully it's not sold out. But if you want to RSVP, the link is meadday.eventbrite.com. Also, if you go to enlightenmentwines.com, there'll be like a little button on there. You can look at it. And, you know, it has a whole schedule and everything. But basically the bottom line is, it's like, if this interests you at all, it's a really nice chance to come in. Just try a bunch of stuff. It's really low pressure. No one's like selling anything really that you don't want. And it's free. So,
And the bar is beautiful.
So it's and it's a great place. I'm very proud of what we did there. I'd also like to say that, you know, for me as a mead maker, it's really important that this will be the first time that I've met some of these guys. I think they're all guys, pretty much, like one-on-one in different places. But we haven't had the chance to, like, get together. 810 Meadworks is, like, all the way upstate New York, like, really far away. You know, All Wise is actually, they're opening up in Williamsburg. But Dylan, who runs it, he's an actor, so he's not around a lot. So I just got to see him. And, like, I'm really looking forward for all of us to get together one place and maybe hoping to, like, start a mead association so we can kind of have some sort of formal conversations about nomenclature and what are we going to call these things, and let's agree on, like, you know, if we want to, like, influence legislation, it's nice to have a group together.
Absolutely. And it sounds like those are things that are important and valuable. I mean, as you point out, you know, with mead being made at home, mm-hmm. and also this kind of, like, fake Western mystical, mm-hmm. like, medieval thing surrounding mead, that in the modern age, that for, you know, for small companies, that's important. It's important.
Well, also, it's sort of like, look, most people don't know what it is. I think we're trying to define those terms ourselves right now.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, educating the public on what mead is or what mead can be is kind of the most exciting part of the project, right? So, but it's also the most work.
Right.
So this is sort of a step in that direction.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Raphael, so much for taking time out of your busy mead making days.
Oh, great.
And coming down here to the studio.
Oh, and we should mention, if you didn't get enough of me, I'll be on the radio again on Friday.
That's right, Friday on WNYC, and actually, I guess, syndicated nationally on Food Fridays.
It's midday is the show now.
Okay.
It used to be the Low Paid Show, but now it's midday. And then they do Food Fridays.
On WNYC and on NPR. So
yeah, I'm excited.
Tune in for more.
Great.
And you can find more at, you can follow Enlightenment Wines on Instagram.
Yep.
You can check out
if you can spell Enlightenment.
Yeah.
If you can spell Enlightenment, you can
That's
follow
the barrier
us.
To entry, right?
Yeah, it's hard. try a few times, you'll get it.
And check out meadday.eventbrite.com or, you know, stop by at 93 Scott Avenue. And Honey's is open normal bar hours, like 5 to midnight or 5 to 2, whatever.
No, we're open late, man. On the weekends, we're open to 4.
Wow.
That place gets crazy at night. But yeah.
Oh, and I should point out, I should mention also, if you go to Honey's, you have to taste the kvass.
Oh, yeah.
If it's on tap.
It's back. Yeah.
It is one of the best beverages I have ever had pass my lips.
Thank you so much.
Right here, out into the world on the radio.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Raphael. Okay. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Harry.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to David Tatasciore, engineers this show every week. Don't forget to head over to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and support this and all the other great shows here on HRN. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to like the show on any of those formats if you did, in fact, enjoy it. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can find me on social media at TheFoodBaller. Thanks a lot. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.